Good evening, folks, and welcome back on this Saturday, the 8th of February, 2020. I'm your host, Mark Call. And any way you slice it, this has been one of the busiest, most disconcerting, and even downright disgusting weeks in recent memory. And as you know, that's saying quite a bit. There was a bit of good news this week, though, even some closure as well. So how do we start off trying to summarize a week like this? Let's kick it off anyway with a bit of the good news, even if you've probably already heard it. Inevitable, but it wasn't quite a lead pipe cinch, because there are no doubt plenty of turncoats, rhinos, and sellouts in the Senate. But when push finally came to shove yesterday, and the vote was actually held, only one of the very worst of the rhinos truly demonstrated the yellow streak that characterized this guy's public life. So here we go. At 4:30 p.m. Eastern Time, Wednesday, February 5th, 2020, the Senate impeachment trial vote was concluded, and while two-thirds or 67 votes were needed to convict, and that was obviously not going to happen, what did happen was right straight down party lines. And that's more than true if you recognize that Mitt the Rhino Romney, with his corruption and Burisma connections to boot, voted with his ideological colleagues on the socialist far left. But the attempted coup still went down in flames, 52-48 in favor of, well, nothing to see here, move along, move along. And that was Article 1, of course, the so-called abuse of power, with the evidence basically boiling down to the president is not a far-left socialist, so therefore anything he does must be an abuse of power, especially if it boils down to exposing criminality among those who are allowed to abuse such power. When it came to Article 2, even Mitzona, check your Hebrew dictionary, couldn't swallow that one. Obstruction of Congress, for crying out loud. And the vote to say, are you kidding, was not guilty by 53-47. Think about it, folks. This one is so idiotic that otherwise, every time the president tried to issue a constitutional veto, he's guilty of obstruction of Congress. And here we thought that the occasional Cortex was the only idiot on the far left who'd never actually bothered to read the part about separation of powers. On this particular occasion, however, wrong way Romney may have actually upstaged the occasional Cortex. Listen to this bit of blithering idiocy. As the New York Times quotes him concerning Mr. Trump's actions in the Ukraine, the leftist constitution hater masquerading as Republican said that his actions were, quote, the most abusive and destructive violation of one's oath of office that I can imagine. Which shows that he not only despises the Bill of Rights and all kinds of actions that are far more destructive, and he's blind as a bat to actual abuses, but he doesn't have much imagination either. The quote of the day, though, came from the most infamously evil senator on the floor moments before the vote. And for once, folks, he actually told the bold, unmitigated truth. Quote, the verdict of this kangaroo court will be meaningless, said Chucky Schumer of New York. And I gotta say it, why the hell didn't he come out and admit that months ago and save this country a whole lot of time and turmoil? Well, we know the answer, because they're not even done yet. And the biggest legacy of this whole witch hunt remains obvious. Never before in American history has there ever been a vote, either for impeachment or conviction, that was so utterly, transparently partisan. Speaking of which, quick aside here, and that's certainly all it's worth, the New York Times actually printed an op-ed from Ohio's Socialist Senator Sherrod Brown entitled, In Private, Republicans Admit They Acquitted Trump Out of Fear. Yeah, folks, it's all about how Republicans were afraid to convict the president in the absence of any actual crime or even evidence. They were fearful, he claimed, that Republicans were afraid their head might end up on a pike. But isn't it funny that in this whole piece, not so much as a hint of the fact that there wasn't a single Democrat with the integrity or the backbone to vote for acquittal in the absence of any actual high crime or misdemeanor? There's more related news on that front to recap in just a minute, but first, a look back at an earlier event in the week, the State of the Union Address by President Trump, which was actually quite well done and generally well received, with an obvious and notable exception or two from the Bolshevik Revolution side of the House, which honestly probably said more about the true State of the Union than the speech, especially if you paid attention on the video to the anger on the faces of the conspirators. and probably one of the most childish displays we've ever seen by one of the most unprofessional political hacks ever to infest the District of Criminal Swamp. And as you know, that's saying quite a bit. I'm talking about petulant Petty Pelosi, of course. And if you haven't seen it, folks, you really ought to watch the video. It'll be easy to find. Of a childish, scowling, nutcase Nancy Pelosi literally having a temper tantrum right behind the rostrum, ripping up the speech after it was all over. And hopefully, it's all over for her. Even the New York Times summary called it a spectacle in the House chamber on Tuesday night and said that after her display of disdain on Tuesday, Ms. Pelosi told reporters she'd ripped up the speech because it was, quote, a manifesto of mistruths. But earlier, she claimed it was, quote, the courteous thing to do, considering the alternatives. So the New York Times, she did not elaborate on what else she'd considered. Thankfully, folks, if one of the options was mooning the president and the people of the United States, well, at least she avoided that disgusting spectacle. Later in the week, she even doubled down and actually claimed that she didn't need any lessons from anybody, especially the President of the United States, about dignity. Well, folks, no doubt about it. She doesn't have any and clearly doesn't ever intend to want any. But when it came to childish displays in the House of Representatives, this may have been one of the most ridiculously inane, juvenile things in the history of that no longer honorable chamber. The official White House Twitter account said the following about Petty Pelosi's unprecedented gesture. She just ripped up, they noted, one of our last surviving Tuskegee Airmen, the survival of a child born at 21 weeks, the mourning families of Rocky Jones and Kayla Mueller, a service member's reunion with his family, and that's her legacy. I was kind of disgusted, folks, to see that she couldn't even bring herself to politely applaud historically low black, Hispanic, and teenage unemployment rates, for crying out loud. Or even some of the standard platitudes and truisms that, at least once upon a time, both parties pretended to care about, like American freedom and liberty, and even parts of the Bill of Rights that they've clearly demonstrated they so roundly hate. When the president referenced his support for the First Amendment, and then, horror of horrors, the Second Amendment, and the camera scanned the scowling, gun-banning socialist crowd, you might have thought for a second we were watching that bunch of Marxists hear about free enterprise. I guess at least the good news is the gloves are off and they're no longer trying to hide their disdain for truth, justice, and the American way. So in spite of the respectable list of accomplishments that the president outlined, as well as a generally well-delivered address that not only hit the high points, but certainly struck a conciliatory tone, if not even downright unifying, and here's the real problem, folks. He unhesitatingly expounded traditional American values, from love of God and country, to family, to the rule of law. And that seems to have been what really stuck in the leftist craw, and triggered those who were clearly so anxious to destroy it. And so, folks, when all was said and done, it was the bitter hatred that literally showed through the faces of these anti-American Congress traitors that was at least the thing that most struck your host. As Jim Hoft of the Gateway Pundit summarized it, bitter Democrats sat on their butts for record black unemployment, for record jobs numbers, for record wage gains, and near the end of President Trump's speech, they even sat when the president thanked the, quote, hand of Almighty God for blessing this great nation. And it seems they really truly hate him, too. Along those lines, however, one of the real highlights of the night had to be the absolutely shocked expression on Petty Pelosi's face when she realized the president was actually going to call out criminal California for supporting the invasion of the United States by armies of illegals. When Trump got to the part that said, quote, the state of California passed an outrageous law declaring their whole state to be a sanctuary for criminal illegal immigrants with catastrophic results, unquote, which he then proceeded to itemize and outline in gory detail, there were shocked gasps from the assembled traitors, and Pelosi looked like someone had taken away her Nordstrom's card. My administration, concluded the president at the end of that section, has undertaken an unprecedented effort to secure the southern border of the United States. And that, at least, to nutcase Nancy, sounds like another impeachable offense. Interestingly, though, not all of the far-left punditry was sitting on their hands. CNN contributor Van Jones actually warned fellow panelists, according to Breitbart, and Democrats in general on Tuesday evening, that President Donald Trump was actually helping African Americans, quote, in real life and reaching out to them for their vote in 2020. He said specifically, what he was saying to African Americans can be effective. You may not like it, but he mentioned HBCUs, or historically black colleges and universities. Our black colleges have been struggling for a long time. A bunch of them have gone under. He threw a lifeline to them, in real life, in his budget. He talked about that. He talked about the criminal justice reform. He talked about opportunity zones. He talked about school choice. Unquote. And Jones went on to tweet the video of his comments to the CNN panel, adding, "Wake up, folks. The Iowa caucus was a debacle, followed by a strong State of the Union speech laying out Trump's strategy to win, which includes going for black voters. This, he said, was a warning shot from the Trump campaign to liberals, and we need to take this very seriously in order to win." Unquote. Polling results, though, certainly showed that the president won the night any way you slice it. Among independent voters, the latest CBS News poll after the speech showed that 82% of them approved of the president's speech, 97% of Republicans did, and even almost a third of Democrats, or 30%, seemed to think more highly of it than the anti-American leftists posturing in their white outfits. Overall, 76%, or over three-quarters of those who watched the speech, approved of it, and about 56% of those viewers said the president's historic address will actually unite the country, maybe in opposition to the likes of those who despise America with every fiber of their being. Which takes us full circle now back to some of the post-acquittal news. A bit of integrity from Congress that rose above the general swamp level. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, after it was over, trolled the petulant, petty Pelosi child. I guess she's looking to become America's own, even more infantile version of Greta Thunberg. Anyway, in a reference to her undignified, childish display on Tuesday night, he posted a video where he proceeded to rip up the bogus articles of impeachment, mocking her infantile display at the State of the Union address on national TV behind the president, and post the video to his official Twitter account, which hasn't yet been banned. "Acquitted for life," he said as he tore the impeachment articles in half. Which brings me to the interesting news of the day. Representative Matt Gaetz of Florida has written an official letter to the House Ethics Committee requesting an investigation into Speaker Nancy Pelosi's actions to tear up a copy of the President's State of the Union address, arguing that, quote, her unseemly behavior certainly warrants censure. And furthermore, he continued, he's requested a criminal referral for Pelosi's potential violation of 18 United States Code Section 2071 concerning concealment, removal, or mutilation of official documents, arguing that not only do her actions go beyond mere infantile petulance, but they appear to violate both clauses 1 and 2 of the House Rule 23, because they do not, quote, reflect creditably on the House, gee, do you think, or follow the spirit and letter of the rules of the House.
I won't grow up.
I won't grow up.
I don't want to go to school.
I don't want to go to school.
Just to learn to be a parrot.
Just to learn to be a parrot.
And recite a silly rule.
And recite a silly rule.
If growing up means it would be beneath my dignity to climb a tree,
I'll never grow up, never grow up, never grow up.
Not me.
Said Representative Gaetz, President Trump delivered remarks that, quote, received overwhelming and frequently bipartisan support, and they were an uplifting celebration of the diversity of the American experience and the triumph of the American spirit. But meanwhile, Pelosi's theatrics were utterly dismissive of the president's achievements, and more importantly, the achievements of the American people, unquote. And I would add, they were dismissive of the very documents that she put her hand on a Bible and swore to preserve, protect, and defend against all enemies, including domestic ones like her. But moreover, folks, even in a time of rancorous division intended to lead to civil war, they were just nothing short of downright juvenile. In any way you slice it, it's tough to hide from the fact that when the Speaker of the House acts like a four-year-old on national TV behind the United States President's back, but in front of the American people, it's hard to argue that it even remotely reflects creditably on the House. Which leads me, of course, to the interesting irony here. She has clearly violated the House rules and, as it turns out, the law. On national TV, there's no doubt about it, and if the President of the United States can be impeached by this same body for doing his job, but with actually far less evidence, the United States House of Representatives, at minimum, has some credibility to repair here. More importantly, folks, we're a place where lawlessness abounds. And while Scripture has talked about this, prophesied it for a long, long time, as a matter of fact, Pelosi's petulance before the American people this week made it not only abundantly clear, but dramatically obvious why the love of many has grown cold, and we're at a very dramatic cusp. Either the American people returned to the historic vision of this country, a constitutional republic based on the rule of law, and basically the president's vision as he expressed it, or the communist revolution we saw demonstrated so dramatically as the women in white scorned and despised everything that has to do with the Constitution, the concept of the Bill of Rights, and even genuine equality under law before a God that they so clearly despised, as we could see on their faces, and thus where they clearly intend to take this country. A place where not only is Pelosi ripping up the president's speech about those things, but where they literally rip up and defecate upon the very Bill of Rights and Constitution itself. One more case in point here, a story we've been following one way or the other now for what seems like weeks, if not months. It concerns one of the most disreputable, perjuring scumbags, and yeah, outright traitors, ever to head a U.S. so-called intelligence agency. John Brennan, of course. His White House plant, the alleged whistleblower who shall not be named but really is, Eric Sciaramella, 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 and the singular senator who's actually read the Constitution and been pointing all of this out, Rand Paul of Kentucky. Oh, and let's not overlook the eminently blackmailable Chief Justice, sick, of the Supreme Court, John Roberts, who presided over this Senate fiasco, and refused to let the Kentucky senator read his question during the impeachment trial. But on Tuesday, during his closing comments, Senator Rand Paul actually and finally read his question aloud on the floor of the United States Senate, after which the current scumbag and former CIA director John Brennan lashed out at the good senator for blowing up their impeachment trial by dropping the name that shall not be named, when he named not only anti-Trump CIA operative Eric Sciaramella, but his national security crony turned Schiff aide Sean Misko, right there on the Senate floor, before God, the American people, and everybody. Says Christina Layla for the Gateway Pundit, reminding us of what investigative reporter Paul Sperry's been reporting, Brennan planted Eric Sciaramella in the White House in order to spy on the president. And now we've seen Brennan's Russia collusion canard that failed to remove the president first time around, and his second coup attempt has also now gone up in flames. And said the man who should have been wearing an orange jumpsuit long ago in a tweet, Rand Paul is beneath contempt. He typifies the worst of President Trump's craven enablers. Any senator, he continued, excusing this dangerous behavior, i.e. honoring your oath before God, obviously, makes a mockery of public service, sick, and unquote. Oh, wait, no, there's more. History, he says, will revile all of you, unquote. And, folks, not only history, but all of us should revile scumbag, lying, oath-breaking traitors, and I didn't even get all the adjectives in there, like John Brennan. But Senator Paul can certainly hold his own. Quoting the perjurer, here's how he responded. You want to know what's a mockery of public service, John? Killing 500 people outside of any judicial system. Drone strikes on American citizens. Approving British spies to present a dossier of lies paid for by Hitlery. Lying to Congress. Your shame alone should shut you up. Unquote. But an indictment and conviction for treason, folks, would do even better. James O'Keefe of Project Veritas, who's made a career now out of embarrassing the far left, the deep state, and all kinds of liars in the public sphere, has joined the ranks of those that have been banned and locked out of their accounts by Twitter. Evidently, because he published publicly available evidence that a pair of radical leftists with violent fantasies work for the Bernie Sanders campaign. And, of course, that is verboten, and a violation of Twitter's rules. The hypocrites at Twitter claim it's a violation of their rules against posting private information without their express authorization and permission, but that doesn't apply, obviously, if they're far enough left. Because as Zero Hedge notes, when it comes to CNN, they doxed a Florida woman who ran a Trump supporters page without her permission, and even hit her with the Russia, Russia, Russia mantra to boot, and that tweet is still up, along, of course, with the criminally negligent network's account as well. Writes Tyler Durden, Both of the Sanders staffers, Jurek and Weisberger, were filmed going on disturbing rants about armed revolution and re-education camps for conservatives in modern gulags by actual undercover journalists for O'Keefe's Project Veritas. And they also noted there are many people involved in the Sanders campaign who feel the very same way. Says Zero Hedge, it's in the public's interest, you'd think, to know that paid presidential campaign staffers are arming themselves for the f***ing revolution and are also ready to, quote, tear bricks up and start fighting, unquote, before sending, quote, all Republicans to re-education camps. And moreover, they continue, it's in the public interest to identify and distinguish these individuals as paid staffers who've actually gone through a hiring process as opposed to mere volunteers, and who would by definition have a far weaker association with the campaign and its ideals. And while publishing private information would be a clear violation of Twitter's rules, O'Keefe was using publicly available information to correct another so-called journalist, the WAPO's Dave Weigel, on a pertinent fact. And now O'Keefe is currently unable to reach his over 700,000 followers, until, of course, Twitter cuts that number back too, unless he retracts the evidence from the platform. Isn't it interesting, folks, that whether we're talking about the Wuhan coronavirus, economics, or a whole lot of things that you're just plain not supposed to hear about corruption that runs all the way to the very heart of the deep state government, censorship is certainly on the rise, right as things are coming to a head. And at this point, I pause for some excellent comments from Wes Renier at the NC Renegade, who says what a lot of us are hopefully thinking. And by that, I mean if you can't see it by now, wake up. If you needed any evidence that a civil war is coming, he said, go watch the State of the Union speech in its entirety, because it shows that the Democrat communist swamp creatures flat out hate us. They showed their asses, he said, at every opportunity they could. They showed they hate everything we stand for, everything we love, and everything we want America to be. And yeah, he admits, while these communists among us threw an immature temper tantrum last night, I rather enjoyed it. They refused to clap for record low unemployment, rising record wages for blue-collar jobs, shrinking food stamp and welfare rolls, energy independence, and the list goes on. Oh, and not to mention Rush Limbaugh's Medal of Freedom, which was a tactically brilliant move on the president's part to make those commies sit there in silence while his wife put that medal around Limbaugh's neck. Look, he says, I'm not the biggest fan of the president, but what was there to complain about with this speech? Honestly, it was one of the best SOTU speeches I've ever heard. Trump, if anything, is a brilliant showman. He handed these swamp critters their ass last night on a silver platter, and it was a thing of beauty. I think that's why Trump resonates with so many people. He fights. He could have delayed the speech until after his acquittal on Wednesday, but nah. Instead, he went out there and beat them to death. It was rather comical. Trump served up one, sandwich after another last night and made the communist Democrats eat them all. So, if you've watched any of this impeachment clown show and the State of the Union address, you should understand by now that civil war is inevitable. These Democrat, communist, socialist, Bolsheviks, etc. will never accept what us deplorables did to them. They'll never accept Trump, but more importantly, they will never accept us. They won't accept our views of the world, our ideals, our guns, and our God. And ultimately, folks, they won't accept his rule of law either, or the principles upon which this nation was founded, and they so clearly detest. We, says Renier, are a very different people from those commies on the left. We value the individual. We value free thought, free speech, free religion. We value freedom. They hate us for it. They aim to rule over us, and we simply will not be ruled by them. But understand, they'll never give up their quest to implement socialist, communist, totalitarianism. They'll never quit. They'll never stop, because we, the people, are their enemy. And yesterday should have shown everyone that. Prepare yourselves, he concludes. War is coming. It's obvious. It's undeniable. As your host, and it's about time the American people wake up. Because the alternative, and we saw its face this week very, very clearly, is very, very ugly, and not to mention violent. Petty, petulant Pelosi may never grow up, but the American people had better, and fast. And you know what? We're almost to the first break here, and I didn't even get around yet to talking about the latest developments in the Wuhan coronavirus booga 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 worldwide pandemic. So we'll pick it up there when we get back.
You better wake up before it's too late. Get ready to rumble. Put all the guns on the line. We're killing out.
Welcome back now to the second segment for this evening, folks. And, of course, there's one big item in the news that we haven't even touched on yet. But as it becomes more and more obvious that not only are the communist Chinese lying about it, but the communist deep staters as well, it's important we take a deeper look at it this evening. I'm talking, of course, about the Wuhan coronavirus, which hasn't been confined to China for quite a while, and that really does seem to be the real problem. Let's start our recap with some of the late updates, and of course, understand that when it comes to numbers, not only are they changing rapidly, but the lies are getting revealed almost as fast as the various communists can come out with them. So here we go. Officially, at least, and these are grossly underestimated numbers, total cases are approaching 32,000, while the official death total, not counting those that die of things allegedly, like pneumonia, is working its way towards 700. Realistically, of course, the real numbers are probably still about an order of magnitude or more higher. In Japan, on that quarantine cruise ship, over 100 people have now been confirmed with the coronavirus. Multiple deaths have now been confirmed outside of mainland China this week in a number of countries. And more major Chinese cities have been put on lockdown. In a piece from Tyler Durden and Zero Hedge late Friday, Guangzhou, the country's fifth largest city with nearly 15 million residents, has joined the ranks of cities imposing a mandatory lockdown, bringing the total number of people in communist China now to over 400 million in quarantine. And as Zero Hedge suggests, if there ever was a reason to believe that Beijing is lying about the numbers, and not just because a company called Tencent leaked what looked like some more realistic data earlier this week, this is it. Mike Adams at Natural News wrote late this week that the NCOV coronavirus is out of control. Containment has been breached, and even mainstream health experts are now warning the world to prepare for a global spread. Meanwhile, Shane Trio at Big League Politics tells us just how far Communist China is willing to go to push their official propaganda. Chinese communists, he says, are demonizing independent content creators on YouTube in hopes that they will be censored by their big tech puppet. Global Times, a tabloid produced in concord with the Chinese communist regime, is demonizing any researchers who contradict their narrative. And there are reports from inside the country that not only are the Chinese, of course, stealing people's cell phones, but literally disappearing various independent journalists who are telling truths that they don't want out. Chris Martinson of Peak Prosperity, whom your host respects, was also singled out by the Chi-Coms as a purveyor of dangerous information. He put out a video saying, "I'm here with some really important messages about the coronavirus." Unfortunately, he continued, "If you've been reading the news, you've either been underinformed or misinformed about what this virus really is." And the Chi-Com seemed very concerned about the fact that his subscriber list is growing dramatically. Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas went on the Senate floor to dispel the official narrative, noting that China falsely claimed for almost 2 months that the coronavirus had originated in a Wuhan seafood market, which is, of course, not the case, as respected publications like The Lancet later made clear. Not to mention the number of researchers reporting about how it's an engineered bioweapon. Well, at least it walks, quacks, and swims like one. In yet another stunning statement, says the piece from Zero Hedge, from the Director General of the World Health Sick Organization, up is down, war is peace, and caution is dangerous. Having once again earlier denied that the newest bioengineered coronavirus is an actual pandemic, saying instead that it's an epidemic with multiple foci, and with people dropping down dead in the streets in China and being forced into ambulances, literally at gunpoint, WHO Director General Tedros reiterated his previous stunning praise for China's, quote, forceful measures to halt the spread of the virus. Meanwhile, another member of the World Health Organization's Emergency Committee on the Coronavirus has accused China of not reporting cases fast enough in the early stages of the outbreak last month, raising fresh questions about Beijing's response to the health emergency. But the double-minded Tedros wasn't done yet. He appeared to blast the rest of the world, too, in other comments, advising countries not to impose trade or travel restrictions on China, saying that such measures can, quote, cause fear and stigma. And asked Zero Hedge, just when in the past did WHO not err on the side of caution? This now seems to be stunningly irresponsible advice from their hype of pandemics past. As Tyler Durden notes, the WHO then proceeded to downplay the risk to public health and took pains to make it clear they don't recommend placing restrictions on global trade and travel at this time. What? Well, if it's possible, and it seems increasingly likely, that we might be dealing with a viral outbreak here at least as virulent as the Spanish flu. We're reminded, they note, of Chris Martinson of Peak Prosperity, who commented that WHO appears to be prioritizing money over human life. Which brings me next, folks, to the economic impacts of the bioweapon epidemic. By the way, if you doubt that, I've got a story sitting here on my desk from Dr. Francis Boyle, who drafted the Biological Weapons Act and has now given a detailed statement in an interview to Geopolitics and Empire, in which he said the 2019 Wuhan coronavirus is an offensive biological warfare weapon and that the World Health Organization, WHO, already knows about it. And he believes the fact that it is a genetically modified dual-use biowarfare weapon is why the Chinese government originally tried to cover it up and is now taking drastic measures to contain it. Well, whether WHO admits it or not, and Dr. Boyle is one of those who seems to believe they're lying, along with your host, the real point is that there are major economic impacts of this perhaps uncontained biowarfare agent now run amok. And in spite of the claims of people like Larry Kudlow last week, White House economic advisor, that the viral outbreak would have, quote, no impact on the U.S. economy, now he says, well, it's not a catastrophe, it's not a disaster, we've been through this before, and I just think the impact is minimal. Now, says Zero Hedge, he does admit it might take a bit longer for China to fulfill some of their promises from the Phase 1 trade deal, especially the part about buying an additional $200 billion or so in American-made goods. A number of others, mostly folks that your host respects far more when it comes to real economic understanding, are saying something very different. Perhaps because we remember that bubbles pop, and when they get really, really big, like the biggest debt bubble in human history, and an overvalued stock market, and globally interdependent supply chain, just-in-time deliveries, and so forth, all it takes is a pin, even a little one, but this is an especially big one, to pop it. But wait a minute, isn't that what the plunge protection team is for? To prevent anything from ever, ever causing a stock market correction? As I do this part of the recording, the Dow Jones is up almost 500 points, above 28,600. S&P is up over 50. The NASDAQ's up about 183 or so. Plenty of pumping going on there. While gold is down 25 bucks, over 1.5%. And paper silver, too, is down another 7 cents today. No fear there. Prompting Zero Hedge to put out this headline, what coronavirus? NASDAQ, writes Tyler Durden, is nearing its record highs as coronavirus cases and deaths explode exponentially, global supply chains collapse, and the world's second biggest economy is basically shut down. Happy days are here again is that tune that you might recall from the previous greatest depression ever. Bonds, they note, though, just aren't buying it, and neither is crude oil or copper or yuan. So sometimes, concludes Tyler Durden, you just have to laugh. Or, folks, your host will add, pay attention and take precautions. So with that, we'll take a look at some of the real impacts, like this one, the continuing repo failure or liquidity crisis, confirming that liquidity is indeed quite scarce to start off the month of February, says a piece from early Tuesday morning. The Fed has conducted its overnight repo, which saw a whopping, well, let's just call it almost $65 billion in liquidity injected. And when you add that to the massively oversubscribed $30 billion term repo, that means the Fed has injected almost $95 billion in liquidity for Tuesday's market needs. All of which seems to mean that the liquidity crisis that continues to percolate just below the surface of the market and has clogged up the critical plumbing within the U.S. financial system is getting worse, not better. But don't worry, be happy is still the prevailing Waystream financial talking head theme.
Don't worry, be happy.
So let's turn instead to a couple pieces from a more Austrian perspective, like this one from Ethan Huff at Natural News, about how China's global supply chains are collapsing due to you-know-what. Reports, it says, indicate that people are increasingly deciding not to travel to China for business. As one example, while cruise lines, airlines, and other components of business and tourism are modifying or canceling their Chinese travel routes, the China Law blog, which is geared toward high-profile attorneys who engage in cross-border business, is now warning its readers that traveling to and from China is not only a substantial risk, it's also increasingly difficult, if not outright impossible. quote, "The coronavirus is impacting pretty much everyone in China," writes editor Dan Harris, whose Harris Brick and Law Firm runs the blog. And despite the fact that entire cities in China are now being quarantined and completely off limits to visitors, travel in and out of many of China's international airports is also coming to a grinding halt. It's taking longer and longer for Chinese people to obtain visas to travel to other countries, and both Chinese nationals and expatriates alike are increasingly fearful of even trying to leave China because, quote, they may be denied entry into the country of destination and may not be able to return to their place of residence, warns the Epoch Times. Meanwhile, the first group of American ambassadors and officials living in China, recently brought back to America via a special charter flight, are now being held at March Air Reserve Base near Corona, California, under that mandatory 2-week quarantine, but there are still many more to go as other foreign embassies and consulates in China scale down their personnel and formulate plans to, eventually at least, try to evacuate them as well. In other words, China's entire economy is rapidly dwindling down as coronavirus continues to wreak havoc both there and abroad. And says Huff, and your host can't help but agree, I've been talking about things like this for quite a while, the implications for all of this for the global economy can't be ignored either, seeing as how China manufactures much of the world's goods, particularly things that end up in other parts and products further down the assembly chain. How long will it be, they ask, before the shelves at Walmart and Target are bare because cheap Chinese garbage is no longer making it to American ports? And if you couple that with the fact that official numbers of coronavirus victims are being kept artificially low in order to save face, the handwriting on the wall becomes clearer than ever. Contends Harris for the blog, virtually nobody trusts the veracity of the Chinese government, and he warns that hospitals are continuing to run out of coronavirus testing kits and continue to classify new cases of coronavirus as pneumonia or other sickness. Oh, and let's not forget, folks, people who point things like that out are increasingly at risk of being banned by the world's socialist media companies. Meanwhile, researchers at Yale University are warning that by Tuesday, the 4th of February, hey, hasn't that come already? There will be 190,000 coronavirus infections in the Wuhan area alone, and there's no telling what the real global number might be. Meanwhile, major corporations like Foxconn, which makes computer chips for Apple, as well as Johnson & Johnson and Samsung Electronics, are all temporarily shutting down production in China. But rather than call it a shutdown, of course, these multinational corporations claim they're simply prolonging the Chinese Lunar New Year holiday break for their employees. Oh, isn't that sweet? Interestingly, one commenter at the Epoch Times puts it this way. Gee, let me cry a big crocodile tear over the greedy companies using slave labor and Christian and Muslim prisoners in order to make cheap products and receive the benefits of no pollution law enforcement. Calling it almost a divine retribution in judgment on Big Brother's public-private industrial partners for even doing business in communist China in the first place. James Kunstler, writing for places like his website and LouRockwell.com, notes that all of a sudden events are looking a bit fluxy out there, as though the world is shuddering through a lot of spooky changes, like a monster waiting to be born, with strange convergences of ecology, politics, and the economy, and there's really only so much you can do to prepare. But nevertheless, criticality is the key word. Because the horses are pretty much out of the barn on the Wuhan coronavirus. Air travel was curtailed, he says, too late in the game, and still only partially, with asymptomatic but infectious human carriers winging to every corner of the globe and probably contaminating airports all along the way. There's plenty of thought and counterthought on exactly what's going on behind the scenes in China, and meanwhile the ruling party has knocked itself out, demonstrating its earnestness, even if it means running roughshod over the peons there, performing great feats like building that 1,000-bed hospital in just a little over a week. But there's also a theory that the coronavirus affords them a cover. Now listen to this, it's a good point. A cover for cascading failures in China's corrupt and shifty fiat banking system. The country had already stepped across frontiers in demographics, energy consumption, and industrial growth that were shoving it towards contraction for the first time in two generations. And, of course, coronavirus has shut down a lot of production in big things like cars and in big little things like cell phones. And supply lines are then shutting down world markets in the chain. This amounts to the first big test of the integrated global economy as well as the world's debt-saturated business model. And here he points out a different aspect of the global, interconnected, just-in-time, fiat-based delivery system. What with a lot of parties and counterparties that can't pay each other because their revenue flows end up being cut off, the securities, currencies, equities, and other abstract representations of wealth tend to go south. The U.S. and Europe are no better positioned for a crisis in their banking arrangements, and confidence is starting to crack. Both economic mega-regions have now relied on central banking hocus-pocus to prop up stock markets and maintain the illusion that the logic of the bond markets still applies. And the first thing to go money-wise in a contracting financial system is the magic of compound interest. In other words, what goes up exponentially can collapse the same way. Kunstler, too, goes on to note that the U.S. Federal Reserve has been massively gaming the repo markets, overnight lending, of course, that uses bonds as collateral, all the way since September, raising suspicions that more than one of its primary dealer banks are actually insolvent. And juicing them with liquidity is like painting over sheetrock infested with black mold. It all looks good for a week or so. Suddenly you're in intensive care. Now that the U.K. has finally actually gone and done it and Brexited, the EU itself is looking even dodgier than it already did, and Europe's bonded debt arrangements, says Kunstler, are even dodgier than America's, since there's absolutely no EU central control of each member's fiscal affairs. Here in the USA, the knock-on effects of the converging crises begin to look like a game of four-dimensional eight-ball. Oil markets continue to get slammed around the $51 hash mark, making it more difficult for the shale oil producers to meet their onerous debt repayments in an industry that just plain doesn't make a profit. And while lower gasoline prices may seem like a boon for U.S. motorists, it comes out at the expense of bankrupting more oil companies and punishing lenders like pension funds that invested in the so-called securities in shale oil in desperate search for yield. Shale never was a rational business model, despite the fabulous production surge in a very short span of years. Free money will do that, folks. And don't be surprised, he says, if there's an attempt to nationalize it, which will induce new problems of capital allocation and sheer incompetence in a world where central planning of anything is more and more a bad bet, even if the far left, of course, remains oblivious. But there's plenty of discord in U.S. politics to go around. President Trump, he writes, and your host agrees, foolishly took credit for financial markets that he'd correctly described while he was running for president as, quote, one big, fat, ugly bubble. Now it's threatening to leave him holding a big, fat, ugly bag of trouble, and that booby trap is surely more hazardous to his reelection chances than the efforts of pissants like Adam Schiff for brains running wily coyote ambuscades in the D.C. swamp. And finally, he concludes, if it all looks bad so far, just imagine if they do manage to put the communist Bernie Sanders in the White House, because he certainly will be able to finish off the economy. Imagine where that will take us. Well, folks, your host suggests we may not have to imagine for too long, because at the rate things are imploding now, we may have a pretty good impression of what the Wuhan coronavirus pin is going to do to the global just-in-time debt bubble before this short month is even out. Which brings me finally to an important question being asked by Bill Holter, Austrian and advisor for Miles Franklin and partner of Jim Sinclair at JSMindset.com, who asks, are you prepared for the contagion? He says up front, it's a question we've been asking if you were prepared financially, mentally, physically, and with your maker for years, but the potential boogeymen we suggested could have come from anywhere or any angle, but the end result would thus affect the economy and the finance and credit markets and spill over ultimately socially. And he says, I have to admit, a pandemic was low on my list of possible sparks or pins, as your host puts it, but after thinking it through, yeah, the pandemic we're seeing could be a financial disaster. Yes, it's also a human disaster. Many will die, but the odds of dying from the virus are low, certainly lower than the odds of being affected dramatically by the financial fallout. The real problem is the human response and what it'll be. I say this, he says, because we do live in a world of just-in-time inventory and production, and we also live in a financial world with more debt and financial leverage, and thus more monthly debt service than ever before in history. So much so that even a small hiccup, which this doesn't look like, where business slows and contracts, would be enough to quickly default some credits. And the problem isn't the initial defaults, rather it's the contagion throughout the system, both financial and medical, because our world is so interconnected, courtesy of globalism. We saw this, he says, back in 2008, where just one entity, Lehman, going down, had the ability to torpedo the entire system. And if it wasn't for the tens of trillions of dollars mobilized from the central banksters, It may very well have imploded back then, and ultimately, your host suggests, we might have been better off because it would have been smaller if it had. And while what followed was called a recovery, but it never really was, today is still different, because back then the central banksters and sovereign treasuries had the ability to print and borrow in an effort to reflate, which they've done continually. But now we live in a world with a debt-to-GDP ratio of 332%, and just who or what has the ability to step up and reflate that? And that last question is a real biggie. Why? Because the financial system and the debt bubble is far larger, maybe close to double what it was back in 2008. And he asks, do central banksters really even have the ability to forestall another crisis like we had back then? Probably not, but that's not the question in this instance, because China and the coronavirus is not a simple snapshot in time. It's the whole movie. By that, he says, I mean there are far more ramifications in some bank with the trillions of dollars in derivatives that it might have blowing up. China is the largest trading partner and manufacturer in the world. And 60 million people quarantined are not working from home, and the factory floors are just closed, meaning final products, components of all sorts are not being produced, shipped, or delivered. And yeah, ponder the ripple effects of that. An even bigger danger in the U.S. is a credit meltdown caused by contagion or even just a break in confidence. And a credit seizure, he says, will be just as bad as a quarantine because nothing will work. We live in a world where everything runs on credit. Production, supply, shipping, and distribution all depend on credit to be able to perform. Not to mention buyers who don't have any other way to buy. Ask yourself, he says, just how many businesses or individuals could weather little or no cash flow for a month or two. So here's the big question. Are you ready for the contagion? Not just the virus, but credit markets seizing up. Do you really believe that without credit, your grocery store will magically stock their shelves, or that there'll be fuel to buy, or power in the grid? And if you haven't thought it through, much less prepared for it, not only is now the time, but it's pretty darn late. Charles Hugh Smith of Two Minds blog summarizes the latest madness of crowds and totalitarianism run amok this way. When we look back at this moment from the vantage point of history, what will we think? Will we think how obvious it was that the coronavirus deaths in China were in the tens of thousands rather than in the hundreds as claimed by authorities? Will we think about how obvious it was that the virus would spread around the globe, wreaking havoc on the global economy and social order, even as authorities claimed that only a handful of cases had arisen outside of China? Will we be amazed at the delusional confidence that the U.S. economy could be untouched by the virus as stock markets continue to soar to new all-time highs while the world's largest economy ground to a halt in a desperate attempt to close the barn door after the horses had already escaped? Will we look back at the patently false data being promoted by authorities and wonder why the majority accepted it as at all credible? And will we re-examine the smartphone videos posted literally by the dozens or hundreds on the web by average people and wonder why, oh why, were all the lies given more credibility than actual first-hand videos and reports? Will we recall, he continues, how content that didn't parrot the approved narrative was banned, suppressed, deplatformed, or marginalized? And will we look back at the claim that only a dozen people in the entire U.S. had that virus, despite all the direct flights from Wuhan and the tens of thousands of people who traveled from China to the U.S. in January, and marvel at our credulity? Whether we're talking the criminal deep state, or things the criminals worldwide intend to do to the deplorables, wherever they find them. So when all is said and done this evening, folks, if there's a single message I can leave you with, it has to do with what you might call a healthy skepticism, particularly when it comes to official narratives that have been revealed time and again as lies. President Ronald Reagan once noted that one of the biggest lies in history was, "I'm from the government, and I'm here to help you." And perhaps, folks, there's never been a better time to remember that that is just as big of a lie today as it's ever been. Whether we're talking communists in Beijing, or the House of Representatives, or all kinds of absolutely unconstitutional, if you read the document, three-letter agencies. Oh, and Reagan also said, trust, but verify. The Bible says, study to show yourselves approved. And that's still pretty darn good advice.